Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Callie Fell, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Hello, and welcome back to Venus Rising. I am really excited today because I get to sit down with nursing colleague Kelly Wilson. I had the opportunity of meeting and working with Kelly when I was fresh out of nursing school several years ago. Kelly has been a nurse since 2010 and joined the ranks of labor and delivery nurses in 2013. In 2019, Kelly started working as a fertility nurse while she was pursuing her degree in nurse midwifery. Kelly is excitedly graduating this spring. She lives in Ohio with her husband and two adorable sons. Kelly, thank you so much for joining me on Venus Rising.
Thank you for having me.
You sound so incredibly busy, working full time, taking care of your little ones. I'm always in awe of women today like you, women who are working and going to school. How do you do it?
I have no idea how I manage. It's a day by day thing. It's pretty crazy. It's been a crazy once school started about a year and a half now. So yeah, we're just ready for the end.
I bet. It's in sight. So tell us a little bit about yourself and how you decided on a career in nursing.
That's a good question. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So when I went to school, I started in education. Then I went to chemistry and then biology and pre-med. And then the school that I was at opened a nursing program. And I decided, well, let me do that. So I'm not in school for the next 10 years.
Yeah. I was in a similar boat. You know, I previously had a degree in reproductive physiology. And so I feel you there. And nursing is great because it kind of combines all of that, right? Like it combines education. It combines the science of things. It's a great field. So when you decided on nursing, did you always want to be a labor and delivery nurse? Did you have your eye on that? And then a midwife?
That's another good question. I don't know. I remember thinking that it sounded really cool to be an OB, but I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And then I had a cousin who's a nurse practitioner who was like, you need to go be a CRNA because that's going to be the best bet for your money. And I was like, okay. And so I got into an ICU right out of school and I mostly hated it. It was a lot. It was okay. I liked the nursing, but the hours were too much. I didn't do well. So then I went into school nursing and then I waited for an OB position to open at the hospital I was at. And it never did. It's like they never had turnover or something. Mm-hmm. And then when we decided to move to Cleveland, there was an OB position and I took it and I've been in there ever since.
Yeah.
I never thought I would go back to school. I had a couple too many bad residents maybe that I was tired of fighting with. And I'm like, you know what? I can do this. If they can do it, I can do it.
Yeah.
So I applied to midwifery school.
That's awesome. And again, that's another great thing about nursing is I feel like there's so many different opportunities to excel, right? Like I give so much credit to med-surg nurses. I don't think they get enough credit. And then you've got, you know, like you said, ICU nurses. There's a niche kind of for everyone. And that's great that you were able to kind of know what you didn't like and then get into something that ended up being wonderful and caused you to go back to school.
Yeah.
So let's kind of focus in then on your care for women and that sort of thing. What do you want to accomplish when you graduate? Or what are your hopes and dreams for women? Do you have anything specifically that through your studies you've really wanted to focus on or make your mission when you become a midwife, I guess?
Yeah. So I think the environment that I work in is a little... So I've worked in a couple like level one facilities, but mostly I've been in like these level three, very acute facilities. And I think there's a culture of birth and pregnancy in general being inherently dangerous or, you know, you're sick or something's wrong with you. And I want to work towards like physiologic birth and understanding that most women were, you know, more or less, we were kind of made to have babies.
Yeah.
And I know that there's people out there, obviously I work in IVF that are completely struggling with that. So That's hard. But I just think that it's hard. Women need, they need an advocate for their birth. And I know we've all been there and seen that birth plan where we're like, oh, this isn't going to go well. But I want them to know that there's at least one person who's like, I'm going to do, if you want to do this weird stuff, let's just do it. Who cares? I don't, yeah. Why does it bother me? It should, it doesn't affect my life in any way. If it's going to make you happy, let's right. do it. Right. So I just want people to just get on board with the fact that we can get into normal labor and have a baby and it's totally normal. And there's, it doesn't have to be this dangerous induction and all these interventions, because it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. They're not, you know, needing to be treated, so to speak. There's nothing wrong with women who are pregnant.
Right.
It's yeah.
And I know that there are sick people who are then pregnant, which is obviously a totally different ballgame, but there's a large group of just healthy people who want to have a wonderful birth experience. It's just a very different field. And people forget that. They're like, you don't go into surgery and tell your surgeon how to do their job. And it's like, no, but they don't, it's just different. Mm-hmm. You got the baby and there's two patients and you don't see one of them. And it's very mm-hmm. different than any other field, I feel like.
I agree. I also work, and for listeners who aren't familiar, level three or acute, that means that the women there are generally sicker or might have what we might call a comorbidity, something else going on. So where I work, we have had patients who have cancer on top of their pregnancy, or like Kelly said, patients who are IVF patients or surrogates or innately higher risk pregnancies. And so that's what we mean by that. It doesn't mean that healthy people or healthy women don't deliver at those facilities. It just means they have the capabilities of taking care of those situations. Can you share with us, without breaking HIPAA, of course, one of your favorite labor and delivery stories?
You know, I can't get over this birth that I had as a midwife student. It was so perfect. She came in, she was in labor, it was her first baby, and she went really fast, actually. We were able to get her in the tub like she wanted. Wow. You know, it was nice to like have the time as the student to be one-on-one with her and labor with her and help her through it. And then all of a sudden she was like, I absolutely have to poop. And I'm like, well, let's get out of the tub. And she had been saying that and like had sat on the toilet already. And then she was ready to deliver, and she got up on the bed and she was in hands and knees, and it was just the most perfectly controlled, beautiful delivery that I've ever been a part of. And I looked at my preceptor and I said, this is midwifery. This is what I want to do. People can do this. And it was just, I don't know if I'm going to be able to top that birth yet.
Yeah. I'm sure you will in your career ahead of you, but you can always... You can always remember that one when you're having a rough day, right? Because right. You know, labor and delivery is not always these beautiful stories.
No,
exactly. And your story's actually making me tear up, because I find, and I'm sure you're the same, like every delivery I'm a part of, it never gets old. I always feel this miracle in the room, and it's truly a great job. But like we said, there are those instances where it's not always what you expect, and it can be very, very sad.
I always say 95% of my job is really awesome, but the other 5% is really, really bad.
Okay, so this is jumping ahead a little bit, but I want to talk about your job in the fertility clinic. But since we're kind of talking about that 5% could be really bad, sometimes, you know, there's heartbreak in the labor and delivery room, but I imagine the same would be for fertility clinics as well. What is the mood like there?
You know, it depends on the patient. We have patients that we all know, which is not good. You don't want to know your IVF staff. You know, you shouldn't know us that well. That we all know you because you've been through so many times. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those are the people we are like desperate to get them a baby, but there's only, you know, we can only do so much. Mm-hmm. So most of the time there's just a lot of anxiety with mm-hmm. the patients, and, you know, there's money and there's the outcomes, and then I do a lot of the procedural related stuff. I don't, by the time I meet the patient, they've already gone through like IUIs and they've done all their medications and they've done all of this and this and this. And I'm just there to like do the procedures. So there's usually a lot of anxiety, and then there's a lot of, there's happy tears and sad tears and anxiety tears. But then other times people are just like, okay, cool, thanks, see you next time. I'm like, okay.
Maybe they're shoving it down or, you know, not dealing yeah. with it. But I recently interviewed a woman who went through IVF to have her own children. She ended up losing a child through IVF, and she just talked about the loss on loss, right? Like she was already right. dealing with the loss of her fertility and that sadness and the challenges that come with that. And then to lose a child through that. And I just can't imagine. My heart goes out to that. And to those women and to you guys, the nurses that work there. So yeah, let's just talk about that. What's a day in the life of a fertility nurse like you like? You said procedures, but what kind of procedures are done? Tell us about that.
Okay. So we have a very, I guess I would say standard day as far as the procedures side goes. So all of our retrievals happen in the morning. Those are OR cases that we find out about 2 days ahead of time. And then in the afternoon, or right in between, like the late morning, I guess, we do hysteroscopies. So that's a procedure where they use a small camera to look inside the cavity to make sure that it's ready for a transfer.
Okay.
And then we have a big whole institute meeting of all the IVF patients. We go over their plans and look at their stimulation and check and see if they're ready for a transfer. And it's a whole meeting. It's like an hour to an hour and a half. It's a very long meeting. And then in the afternoon is transfers. So we have anywhere from 1 to 5 people come in and we take them to the OR and do a transfer.
I see. Do embryo you? Transfer. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Sorry. Embryo transfer. I want to clarify.
No, thanks for clarifying. Thank you for clarifying. Do you in your clinic, do you guys provide or see a lot of like egg donors, or is this mostly just women who are struggling with their own fertility?
It's usually people with their own fertility. We have patients who have received eggs from egg donors, and our embryologist is trying to she's in the process of creating her own bank of eggs to then she can provide those to the women that come through instead of having, we have to right now use like a different egg banking program that mm-hmm. the patients pay for. But we have had quite a few donors come through either just to donate or be part of our program to donate or known donors. So not as frequently, I guess, mm-hmm. but they're there.
And do you have some,
go ahead.
No, please. Sorry.
I was just gonna say we have like, oncofertility. So that's like fertility preservation for people who are going to go through chemo.
Right. So someone will unwrap, can you unwrap that a little bit more for listeners who might not understand why someone who's going through cancer treatment might need fertility preservation, so to speak?
Yes. So a lot of the chemo drugs and the radiation, if they're getting that, can knock out your egg preserves or just completely diminish the quality of the eggs. So we go before their treatments and try to retrieve as many eggs as we can so that in the future, if they are wanting to create, you know, if they want to have babies, then they have their eggs available.
Sure. Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. So since you are studying to be a midwife and your goal is to provide women with as much kind of autonomy to make their own decisions. And, you know, it seems more of like a natural leaning approach. How do you reconcile that with working in the fertility industry? Or do you?
Yeah. I mean, it's a little ironic, the difference. there's some things that I'm like, this is silly, but there's other times where I get it and I understand. I haven't had personally, you know, my own problems with fertility. It took me like 9 months for my first kid, which is nothing, but it felt like torture for 9 months. So I can't even imagine what these women are going through. So I understand that they're like at this point, like just they're desperate and their desire for their own baby. So I'm just there to, you know, give them what their dreams are.
Yeah.
I like to think I hope that some of those women will, after they get the science part of it, will want to like then have the regular, you know, quote unquote, regular, natural, you know, they'll come over to the midwives after that. But some of them are like, I've spent a lot of money and these are very important embryo and this is my pregnancy and I'm going to see a doctor. So, you know, it's, I try not to put the two like together. I don't really think of it as like a anti, they can still have physiologic birth, you know? So I don't, it doesn't bother me, I guess.
No, I just kind of wondered in your mind if you felt that difference and if it, you know, how you reconciled that. So our show exists to help expand our thinking and to educate the public. Education, as we briefly talked about, is a very large role in nursing. In all your years of nursing, what do you think women or even men don't know enough about when it comes to having a baby?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think they understand. I think that most people don't really understand the process in its entirety, but I don't know that they need to know as much as we need to know.
Might scare them away, right?
Right. It's, I'm not sure. I want to say, like, on the funny side of things, that most women are not aware of their own anatomy and are not, I've had a lot of women unaware that a Foley catheter going into the urethra does not affect their baby coming out of their vagina. So just like basic anatomy, but I think just sometimes expectations, you know, I always say people get so upset and they wanted to go natural and they wanted this and that, and it's the first time, and it's, as you probably know, the first time moms are much less likely to have that like perfect standard delivery than on their second and third babies. So I think just sometimes just expectations of what's going to happen, or maybe even like education of what's going to happen when you get there and why you might not want to schedule your elective induction, or I don't know. I'm not always sure that people get a full like risk benefit information about every decision that they have to make.
Yeah, I can see that as well. And it's so funny. I laughed so hard when you mentioned the anatomy, because I was interviewed for the same show when we first started. And that was my example as well. And still to this day.
That's so funny.
Yeah, to this day, it still baffles me that I have to explain that it's okay. Like, this isn't the same hole. And yeah, anyway, so funny. To follow up with a different question, but kind of similar, what is one or two things that you would want women to know specifically as it relates to their reproductive health? Like, if you could just kind of be like, women, know this, or educate yourself on XYZ.
First of all, I wish that they all knew our job as a midwife, like what we are as compared to like your standard OBGYN, and how different the care is, I guess. Not that you're getting bad care from a doctor. I'm not saying that in any way, but
certainly not. Certainly not.
Sometimes, you know, you just get, it's just different. You know, midwife means with woman. So we are there as we, I feel like, I don't know what I'm trying to say.
I feel like you guys, midwives have an opportunity to spend more time with the women.
Yeah. Yeah. We want to, we have the desire to spend more time and to do more education. And I think just having a patient being aware that they can, that they do have a say, like, I don't like what I've noticed in school. I guess I can't even think about how I felt before school, but I can't think of like, did I notice it before that the doctor, well, I shouldn't say doctor, the provider, some providers will come into the room and be like, okay, well, we're just gonna break your water now. And that's the next step. And there's no discussion. There's no, what do you think? Or how do you feel? And here's risk benefit and blah, blah, blah. Like, you can always, people can always say no to stuff. And we are like, how dare you say no? I'm like, well, they don't want it. It's, what do you mean?
Their body. We preach this, like, your body, your choice in other arenas. But then I feel like sometimes in the labor and delivery room, all of a sudden the woman has an opinion and we kind of frown at her for it.
Right.
So,
yes. Yes.
And of course, if your health or your baby's health is on the line, then certainly we want to try to treat appropriately. But well, in situations, right,
yeah,
that are not that urgent.
Right.
Then let's talk about it. I always offer patients the opportunity for me and the team to leave the room to chat and then come back. What questions do you have now? What, you know, and I think I learned that in Ohio actually, but I think it's a great little, you know, just give people their space. But is there anything else that you would want women to really understand or know?
I feel like I do a lot of birth control education and people are unaware of all the options, and it's really important because people don't know that they can be in charge of their reproduction. Mm-hmm. And I guess just it can be really hard to be a woman, and we have to be our own advocate for like something's not right and I want it to be fixed. Here's a good story. Patient came in. I can't use exact ages. Anyway, she came in and she was currently in what would be considered like a perimenopausal age.
Okay.
And okay, she's not having periods. That's fine. A little spotting here and there. That's cool. You know, that's pretty normal at this time of her life. And when asked, you know, how long has this been going on? She's like, oh yeah, I haven't had a period in 14 years. And you're like, well, that's abnormal. And why? But then you're like, well, am I the one that's abnormal? Because out of 14 years of healthcare visits, no one else has thought that this was abnormal, that in your earlier like 30s, you were just menopausal.
Mm.
Like, and the patient hears that from a provider and they're like, okay, well, that's my life now. Mm. And I just feel like women need to know that maybe just because a provider says something doesn't mean that it's normal or yeah, that more shouldn't be done to help them or that this is the end. Like,
yeah,
this is the official diagnosis and nothing can be done about it. People get very weird about stuff. I'm like, you know, ask more questions.
Ask questions. That's exactly what I was just going to say. Even when my mom goes to the doctor, I'm like, ask more questions. Why didn't you ask that?
Yes. I'm always like that. I'm like, well, then what did you ask? And they're like, nothing. I'm like, okay.
Or they'll come home and not completely understand their treatment plan.
Yeah. Right.
And, you know, it kind of baffles me. But I do think that there's still some like intimidation and we just kind of take our provider's word for things. And then, you know, so.
Right.
Right. But yes, I agree. Be your own advocate.
Mm-hmm. I think that's it. I don't know what else.
No, that's great. That's great.
I feel like I could think of more specific things. I just can't.
No, that's okay. And if stories come up, that's great. I think people like hearing stories. You know, they like to know that their experience wasn't unique, or they like to know that they're not alone. Or so if anything pops in your head, please just cut me off. I think stories are always a great way to educate people and to start conversation. So you've been a labor and delivery nurse for some time now and close to becoming a midwife. Woohoo.
Yeah.
A lot of my work at the Center for Bioethics and Culture, the organization that hosts this podcast, focuses around third-party reproduction. So okay, like I said, using an egg donor, surrogate, and studies are showing that women who have IVF, so a surrogate in this example requires IVF to become pregnant, they have increased risk for adverse outcomes for mother and baby. Do you see this in your work in Ohio? I definitely feel like I see this anecdotally here in California, but do you see this at play?
That's a good question. I always feel like also like anecdotally when I see patients that come back for IVF and they've had their, you know, they've already had a baby, 9 times out of 10 it's been a C-section. And I don't know why. And I feel like as an RN, I noticed that they always seem to have some kind of problem in their, either in their pregnancy or in their delivery, like they're preeclamptic or they had to have an emergency C-section or, you know, there's like, especially if it's like a egg donor or embryo donation, like they just seem innately higher risk. Yes. I don't know what the science has behind it. I haven't actually looked into like research, specific research about it. I just know what I've seen.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is important too. No, research is actually starting to show that women who've had IVF do have higher incidences of preeclampsia, which is where your blood pressure gets high or you have protein in your urine or other things. And also, I guess one of the theories around it is that if you think about bodily donations, that this is the egg or an embryo that's not the woman's, the body has some sort of, it knows it's not its own, if that makes right. sense. And there's some sort of response. So it's interesting. It's an interesting theory. I think there needs to be more research. Well, I don't think there needs to be more research on this. For I think sure. women's health, there's not enough research. Do you feel like, again, working in the Bay Area, I feel like I take care of a lot of older patients that are using IVF to become pregnant because we're putting mm-hmm. off starting a family for careers and whatnot. Do you see this in Ohio as well? I feel like the population of pregnant women when I worked there was a little bit different.
Yeah, I think like our non-IVF patients that come in are, a regular age that you would see in childbirthing, like the 20 to 35 or, mm-hmm. Even 40, but I guess in IVF, yeah, we do see a lot more in the 40 to like 40, 40 plus range. And they have a much lower pregnancy rate, I'm sure, than the younger women. A lot of the times their pregnancies are better. If they have an embryo that was made when they were like 35, then that's usually okay. But if they had an embryo made when they were 45, it doesn't always do very well. So usually that next step is egg donation mm-hmm. For them.
I read a book by Miriam Zoll about her fertility experience, and she felt that largely she misunderstood or didn't feel like she was accurately given success rates. Do you feel like women either aren't given good information or they're ignoring that good information are they
I understand.
More optimistic, I guess, than what doctors are portraying? Or what are your thoughts on that?
I ask myself that question a lot. I do believe our doctors are giving them numbers. We have it printed out. So I think that they're given that information. I think that they see that 1% and hope that that's them though. And they're just not ready to go to like an egg donor. They're just not ready. So they just want to try anyway. Mm-hmm. But I do think that they're given information. Plus, the ASRM website, I believe, has all that information like to public knowledge. And I don't know if it has like site specific information, but I think that patients, if they went to that website, they would have those numbers in front of them anyway. So I don't think there's any like hiding. They're not like, oh yeah, we're going to miraculously get you pregnant. I don't think that's happening, but I don't know. I guess for sure. I'm not listening to the teaching appointments.
Sure. Who largely does your education? Is that the role of a nurse, a doctor, a coordinator?
We have all the patients meet with a doctor first. They do a consult with the doctor to see if they're appropriate and go through all the options and the different choices. And the doctors look at all their blood work and all that stuff. And then they have a nursing teaching appointment. So that's, pre-COVID, it was live, in person. Husband and wife came in. They learned about their protocol that they were going to be on, all the steps that were going to be happening, how to give their injections, what was going to happen with each thing. It's starting to come back now that, I don't know. COVID's still around. It was virtual for a while, and now I see more people are coming in to get their appointments again. But I feel like they have a decent amount of education.
Speaking of COVID, actually, I was reading some articles that, women were missing out on their opportunities for their cycles because of COVID. Did you see that in your clinic? And how did COVID affect your workflow and providing for the patients?
Yeah. So we actually, when COVID first started, it was right around, when was it? Probably April through the beginning of June, we completely shut down. So we had no patients at all. We finished up starting the beginning, like end of March, beginning of April, we just finished up people who had already started stimulation meds. but we canceled all transfers and we canceled all other services. And we were basically completely closed for that amount of time. And then we started back at a very low volume. I think we're not just now at the point where we're back up to like full volume of patients, like getting started on medication. We try to keep transfers to a certain number so that there's not too many people coming into the building. And then husbands really don't come back for anything. So that's been a lot of problems for people. And that's been our biggest complaint, I think, as far as COVID goes, that the husbands can't be there for the transfers. And then when they're there for their surgery, they have to like wait outside basically.
Yeah, that's really hard.
Yeah.
Patients who come in, they get really excited when we do a little ultrasound to make sure, you know, baby's head down if it's an induction, because that's the first time usually that the husbands have seen live ultrasound.
We just opened that husbands can come to all ultrasound appointments are fair game. Prenatal appointments are just the woman, or just the birthing person, the pregnant person, but ultrasounds, the husband, the partner can come.
So for a woman who's never been to a fertility clinic and she's thinking about making an appointment, could you shed some light on what she could expect and how her, you kind of talked about this a little bit already, but just kind of what she can expect?
Yeah. So I would say the first appointment is usually the doctor appointment. So you're having a consult. As far as I only really know our clinic, but I think it's somewhat standard. The first appointment is with the doctor. They look at, and at that point, they will probably order all of the blood work. And then you'll have to meet again to go over all of that blood work. Because if you're just meeting with them the first time, you probably haven't gotten all the thousands of blood work options you have to do. we usually start with is the most indicative of how the stimulation will go. And it's called AMH. It's anti-Mullerian hormone. And that is just a way to gauge how you will stimulate. And that's how they base different protocols of medications on. After that, there's more blood work. It's just a lot of blood work. It's just after over and over and over. There's genetic screenings that we do and just STD screenings. Everybody gets that. And if there's other more specific stuff that gets done, if there's any kind of third party donation, because it's all done through the FDA, it's all regulated by the FDA. So there's other like psych evaluations and that kind of stuff that has to get done before you even get to the starting your stimulation process. And then there's a bunch of ultrasounds and more blood work until you are ready for a retrieval.
So, and maybe I misunderstood earlier, when you do retrievals, do you perform retrievals on egg donors at your clinic?
Yes.
Okay. And then are you guys, so a new kind of fad, I guess, if you will, in the fertility industry is egg freezing for later. Do you guys provide that as well as at your clinic?
Yeah.
Do you see a lot of women coming for that service?
We do. I feel like there's been an increase, and I don't know if it's just because I'm paying attention more, but yeah, we get a lot of egg freeze patients, whether it's like for oncofertility, like I said, for cancer preservation, or just the, you know, 38 plus age group is doing a lot of that as well.
I see. Yeah. Some of the industries, like the tech industries here, are providing that as a, I guess you could say like a HR benefit for their employees is egg freezing. Mm-hmm. And so that it's very interesting. So a lot of young women, I have a friend who actually just chose to do that. So yeah. So I really don't want to keep you too much longer just because I know that you're so, so busy, but I have a few more questions, if that's okay. I am sure that women are often very scared or emotional prior to getting a procedure. What would you tell women listening right now that might have a procedure scheduled or who is nervous about her own fertility?
I would say, I know that we talked about advocating for yourself and asking a lot of questions, but also there is a time where you're going to have to do a little bit of trust of your provider. And if you don't like your provider, you don't trust them, find a different one for sure. But there is a lot of, I don't want to say guesswork, but everybody responds differently to the different medications and everybody has different reasons that they're needing to go through fertility, whether it's egg factor or a male factor or genetic screening that they need done. So it's hard to compare yourself to another patient because everybody is so different. I feel like, I don't know if it's just at that point of their, by the time they get to the retrieval and everything, they've already gone through so many steps and they're just a planning type of person. There's a lot of type A people that seem to be coming through. What happens next? Like, brain to stop doing that. That's the only way you're going to get through, is to just try to, like, day by day, just wait. You got to be a little bit patient because it's hard. It's just going to make you more anxious and more freaked out. And I don't know if it's easier for me to tell you to stop doing, just to calm down and, you know, wait. But I guess that's my only advice, is to try to let the process happen as it's happening and don't, like, move on to the next step yet. Like, be in it.
What are the procedural rooms and recovery rooms like? Like, just if you know, sometimes we have patients in antepartum. So these are patients who are not quite at labor and delivery, but they need to be hospitalized. And so we kind of walk them through the OR. We kind of walk up so that they know what to expect. It kind of brings down that anxiety. So yeah. Can you shed light on what those procedure rooms look like? What the recovery rooms might look like?
Yeah. So we have basically like a pre-post-op area, and we use all those rooms as before your retrieval, after your retrieval, and then before and after transfers. So they're all just like a very small, they fit like a bed and a couple chairs and a table and a computer type rooms. Mm-hmm. And then the OR is basically looks like an OR. It's just a little bit smaller than your standard OR. And ours is kind of interesting that it has basically like one of those, what am I trying to say? What is it called? Pony door or something, you know, where like the top half opens, the bottom half opens, so, and it connects directly with the lab. So when we're doing retrievals, we're getting the vial of the fluid and we're handing it directly to the embryologist. And the same thing happens with transfers. They're going right into the lab and they're walking over directly into the OR. So our embryologist she's very proud of herself for her design that she made. She made the whole space exactly how she wanted, with specific air filtration and all this very specific stuff to make it the best. But I know that we just had a patient who had a transfer at a different location. She said that it like got sent in like through like one of those vacuum tubing systems to the OR. So they're all very different, but I would say ours is like, it's also dimly lit and a little bit warmer than your average OR. Sure. So I think that's probably pretty basic.
Yeah.
Pretty standard, but
yeah,
I know people who don't like doctors in general would be probably nervous to walk into an OR or to see even a pre-post room as just a stretcher in there, but they're not super scary rooms. There's not a lot of like equipment, I guess, to be too scared of. But
do you see a lot of side effects or complications from the drugs that these women might be put on or the procedures that you help with?
A lot of them have different complaints about, as far as stimulation drugs go. Some of them are like headaches or nausea. Some people have that kind of side effect. Usually the medication, by the time it's time for retrieval and you've had, you're ready to like be retrieved, there's a lot of bloating and cramping usually, which is a side effect that's expected. So it's not abnormal. As far as the procedure, there's not too many reactions or side effects that happen. Sometimes people have, the biggest one is bleeding that happens. It's in a very vascular area that it's happening. So there can be one of those risks of the procedure, but it's very, very rare. I'm knocking on wood because it's very rare. I guess that, I mean, just there's, you know, some people complain of like hormonal change. I mean, we're giving you hormones. So some people are like acting, they're extra emotional, or they're saying that their partner thinks that they're a little crazy that week, or, you know, it just, everybody kind of responds to it differently.
How long are, after a procedure, how long typically are women there with you before being sent home?
About 30 minutes to 45 minutes.
Oh, wow. That's quick.
Yeah. We just make sure that they're a little more alert, that they're
like hemodynamic stable, like blood pressure, heart rate is all stable. Mm-hmm. There's not bleeding, and that they can go to the bathroom and then they get to go home. They're advised to not do anything once they get home. They're on, they get what's called a MAC sedation. So it's monitored anesthesia care, which is basically some medicine to relax you, medicine to sedate you, but you're breathing on your own. So it's just, it usually causes, people don't usually remember anything about the procedure or very closely thereafter. So, but they're breathing on their own. So it is a quicker recovery.
Right. Do you have anything else that you would like to add? Any other stories that you would like to share before we end our time?
Oh, I have so many stories, but
okay, give us one more story then. It can either be from any facet of your life or an education.
As far, well, I guess IVF is fun stories, but some of our more interesting patients right now, well, this is a whole nother thing we could talk about, are somewhat, I guess it's somewhat related to your third party information, but we have uterine transplant patients, and I find that extremely like mind-boggling to even know that it's a thing, and it's really cool.
Yeah, wasn't Cleveland originally, they were going, the Cleveland Clinic was going to be one of the first to do that, and I don't think it was successful, or I can't quite remember, but that was right about the time I started my nursing career, and I remember reading about that.
Yeah, they've had 4 successful babies, and I think originally they were approved for 10 different transplants, only 8 of which have been done so far because then COVID hit. But yeah, 4 babies so far. So it's kind of hit and miss. We still have people trying to get pregnant and people who weren't successful. And it's cool because it's all a trial. So it's all been free to the patients. You know, they got a whole stimulation cycle and everything has been free to the patients. So it's been nice to give these women, most of the women are people who were born without a uterus. So, you know, to make them feel like they are like everyone else. So that's been actually really cool.
Yeah. So do you actually get to be a part of the transplant, or are you after the fact?
No, we're just the transfer. So after they do their whole cycle and then they get a transplant and then they're on meds for a while to make sure they're stable, and then they can do actual transfer.
Mm. Do you know how long they have to kind of be stable or be on those medications before they can?
Transplant stuff, I think it's like 6 months to a year before they can try and get pregnant.
I see. And then for our listeners, those women do not keep those uteruses or uteri for the remainder of their life.
No. Yeah. No, they have a C-section delivery, and I think the trial was approved for another, but I think they've all had all of the uteruses have been removed at that delivery.
During the C-section.
Don't hold me to that, but
yeah, pretty no, sure. Of course. okay. Well, I'm going to throw kind of a question from out of nowhere at you then. What are your thoughts on, you know, the transgender movement and men getting...
No, I was going to talk about that. Yeah. So we do have our fair share of transgender and, you know, with the LGBTQ community obviously comes through kind of frequently.
Sure.
So that's why I've been trying to get my language better, just, you know, with partner. And yeah, so I don't think it doesn't matter to me what you do, where, who we are. We get a lot of men, transgender men that come through, not a lot. We've had a handful of transgender men come through to donate eggs. And then sometimes it's their partner that is then going to be the pregnant person.
Mm-hmm.
But we've also actually at the hospital delivered 2 transgender men. So I guess it's whatever's going on with the couple and how they want to reproduce. So it's very crazy, but awesome that it's just a crazy thing that we can do for them.
Hmm.
Not bad, obviously. I'm not saying crazy bad. I'm saying,
yeah. No, it's
science, man.
It's wild. Awesome. It's wild. I'm not sure I feel the same as you as far as, to me, it just seems really, it seems like women have children, you know, and to take a uterus from a woman and put it inside of a man so that he can have a child. I haven't wrapped my head around that. I'm not sure I will, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, there's not like a uterine transplant into a man. So all of the transgender men have their own uterus.
Gotcha. You know? Yeah.
So transgender male means that they were born with female anatomy and they now identify as a man. So a lot of them still currently have their female anatomy. So they use it.
Right.
They just happen to look like a man on the outside.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I guess my question was more specifically how you feel about the potential of advancement of a biologically male person.
Oh, like then receiving uterus?
Yes.
Oh, I don't know if we're there yet.
Oh, I don't think we are, but I wonder if we will, you know, it's like this, it's been moving so quickly.
It has. And I think, you know, whenever I talk about this to people who aren't involved in like OB or IVF or like my husband, for example, he's like, you know, people just don't, I think we just get an abnormally large amount of exposure to it in the field that we're working in. So not everyone is even aware of the fact that it is moving so quickly or that this kind of thing is even happening. And like a girl that I'm in school with right now works at a birth center who has a male midwife and a transgender male midwife who is also pregnant. So that there's a lot of things going on there, but he brings in a huge amount of LGBTQI patients. So it's really supportive to them to see someone like them, you know? So I don't really care, but I'm going to predict it's going to be a long time before a person, so that would be a transgender woman, gets like a uterine transplant. Mm-hmm. That would become very, not only costly, like it's very expensive.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think we're far away
from that. The whole thing is, right? Like IVF is very expensive. Do a lot of patients, I know I keep saying we're going to wrap up, but I just keep coming up with questions. Do a lot of women or couples that you see, do they have, and maybe you don't know this because you're in the procedural room, but are they covered by insurance? Do you see that most people are having to pay for these types of out of pocket?
There's not a lot of insurance coverage, I would say. Most people are self-pay, I think are it's why we make so much profit for the companies, because we're mostly self-pay. Some people get like partial coverage, or they'll get a coverage of something but not other things, or they get medicine but not all the medicine. It all kind of depends, but it's definitely a very big factor in what goes on for people.
Yeah, it seems like the fertility industry is a little bit, you know, it's for the wealthy, you know.
I know. And I know different areas have really good coverage, and some, like you said, that there's places that are doing, you know, egg freezing coverage. And I think a lot more people would take advantage if there was more coverage. I think it's stopping a lot of people from doing it, which I don't know if it's good or bad. Are they choosing to not have babies? Are they choosing to go into adoption? I don't know what they're, and if they just absolutely cannot afford it. I mean, but there's people taking out loans and stuff and going into debt because of it. So I don't know. I feel like there should be more coverage, insurance coverage. I don't think it's fair, I guess. Not that people should be entitled to it, but I don't know. I don't know what to say.
Yeah. And it's hard for me too, because, you know, in the United States, especially for women of color, we actually have really a lot poorer outcomes than other countries. And, you know, if we know that, and other countries, of course, have IVF and fertility industry, but if we know that these things can cause higher risks and can cause complications, how much of those complications are occurring because we are kind of fiddling,
right,
so to speak, you know?
Yeah. I thought about that a lot too. I don't know. I try to just...
Well, you're a nurse who's there to provide really good care when you need to, and you... You know, and that makes a good nurse, right? Someone who's able to provide care no matter what the patient may look like, what they believe or what they are going through. So I know that Kelly is a good nurse. I've had the privilege of working with her. So if you get her, you are a lucky, lucky family. So Kelly, our time, we're going to wrap up, and I want to be respectful of your time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to meet with me and share your stories and your expertise. It's been wonderful to chat and catch up. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Yes. I'd like to also thank each and every listener and subscriber for tuning in. Our goal is, as ever, to create conversations, facilitate discussions, and encourage you to think beyond the masses.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes, too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.